This podcast is sponsored by the Columbia Association, who reminds you to learn more about the CA budget at the Behind CA's Budget blog, online at budget1314.blogspot.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of And Then There's That, a bi-weekly podcast of people, politics, and punditry in Harrod County on the HOCO Mojo Network. I'm Paul Scalney, and I'm here at the Mall in Columbia with my co-host, Dennis Lane. Joining us today is Marsha McLaughlin, the Director of Planning and Zoning for Harrod County. But as always, we'd first like to take a look at some of the news making the headlines this week. Dennis, what do you have to get us started?
Well, first I want to talk about two great Harrod Countyans, Sanford and Kay Berman. What a nice thing they did this week. Gave $1 million to the hospital.
And I'll tell you what, I've had an opportunity to meet them, and they are just the salt of the earth, down to earth, just amazing, neat people.
You know what I love about the story, too, and I won't spend too much time except to say thank you to Sanford and Kay, is that these are people that are very modest, no kids, and just... they weren't extravagant and just wanted to do something nice for the place they live and love. And what a great tribute. So thank you, Sanford and Kay, and I'm sure the hospital will put that money to very good use.
I'm sure they will. A lot going on in the schools or surrounding the schools today. It seems to be one of our themes for the day. There's been a lot of talk of the shift in responsibility for the teacher pension.
Yeah.
Which has been really kind of... It's been an issue that's been kind of looming out there for a number of years. And I know I spoke with Ken Allman a few weeks ago, and he was saying that when he took office, I guess there was a $17 million
contribution
being made, and now we're down to three.
Right. He mentioned that at his State of the County address, right.
And, the shift is really putting the screws on Harrod County and our ability to continue the quality of life that we have here. And there's really becoming kind of a public outcry.
Well, there was a great editorial about it in the Washington Post today. The Post
is that a real life newspaper?
Yeah, it's real. Like, I actually have a real.
You still get that?
Yeah, it's not online or anything. I have a really a tear sheet from the paper today, which is pretty unusual. It stands out my stack of papers here. But the editorial board took issue with the governor's approach, and actually, in all fairness to the governor, they laid part of the blame on Mike Miller, the president of the Senate. For their approach to this. And basically, the county's being asked to contribute to something that they have very little control over.
Right.
And, it's a mess. There has to be a solution here somewhere. The state has got a $1 billion budget shortfall. O'Malley is trying a lot of different... He's got a lot of different tricks on his books with taxes and shifting a cost back to the counties. But I don't know. This is a mess.
And what you're obviously talking about is the state-mandated maintenance of effort requirement that says that you can't spend less in any subsequent year than you did the previous year
right.
per student.
Unless your student population drops.
Right. It doesn't incent you to be economical and efficient and look for ways to cut.
No. No, and of course, the governor says, "Well, I have no control over the contracts that the teachers make with the school boards make with the teachers."
Like a lot of things in government, it needs to be turned upside down on its head and kind of come up with a new way to address this issue.
And
it is a problem. Someone's got to pay for it.
Yeah, the Post editorial board went out of the way and said it's all messed up, and O'Malley's kind of got the right idea. It needs to be fixed, but they haven't gone far enough. But there's other school stuff in the news too. I mean, we originally had 15 candidates for three open school board spots.
Now we're down to 14.
Now we're down to 14. First dropout.
Sounds like the presidential election.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was one of the ones. I love this name, Kelly Casey Van Horn. It just it rolls off the lips.
Makes you want to sing.
Kelly Casey Van. I've never met the girl. I don't know anything about her or a woman. She's a recent transplant to Harrod County. I think isn't.
I think she is from Fairfax. She was a former teacher in Fairfax, 34 years old, and a mother of two kids, one and three, and because she has nothing better to do, she thought she'd run for the Board of Ed.
But then she decided maybe she'd like to become a teacher in the system, and being on the Board of Ed might be a problem. So, that was probably a good move for her. But, we got 14 candidates for three open seats. It's going to be a fun election. But, and with all due respects to, I think it was the African-American Coalition of Harrod County sponsored the first candidates forum. For these 14 candidates, but they did it on a Saturday morning from 8 in the morning.
Don't they know the travel basketball's in season?
Saturday morning? Really? Saturday morning from 8 to 1? I mean, that's a long candidates forum for a Saturday morning when, you know, most people have a lot of things to do. And apparently it showed, according to the article by Sarah Toth and Explorer Howard. There were, I think she said about 60 people. Let me see if I can get the quote out of this article. She said it was very sparsely attended anyway. But that's not surprising. You know, Saturday morning. Come on. There is another one, we should say, but before moving on, is that the League of Women Voters is having a candidates forum on March 5th.
And they always do a nice job.
Yeah, they do a nice job. So in case
I do need to take exception to your point, though, about it's going to be a fun election. I'm not sure that any election is all that much fun. And the Board of Ed, really?
Yeah, but see, I write a blog, so this stuff is fun.
Okay, you're a geek.
It gives me, I'll have a lot of topics for blog posts.
The school board also approved the $697 million budget request, which in and of itself isn't that big a story. But what I found interesting about this
was... Did you say 697?
$697 million.
Isn't it 67 million? Is it 697?
$697 million.
Okay, wow, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. What I found interesting about this was that they approved the budget to the penny of what Sidney Cousin requested. You know, with a budget that big,
maybe
don't you think they'd find something that they might not agree with on about with Sidney Cousin, and they change something or nick something or add something or...
And I'm willing to guess that this will be a topic of a lot of candidates will bring up. So, see, they just rubber stamp whatever the superintendent.
Kind of what
wants.
It looks like.
Yeah, well, you know, they got a good point. And
we should point out that it is $697 million, and it does represent, I think, somewhere in the 62-63%.
Right. Close to 65% of your total county budget is going to the school board. So it's a lot of money.
Speaking about not having control over it, right?
Yeah, right. And speaking of the school board, they are... You know, we touched on it a little bit at the last show because right after that was our last show was right after the school board meeting meltdown with Brian Meshkin.
Trying to call in from California, and they said he can't do it.
Yeah, calling in, and then he got upset and he was offended, and his heart was broken. I think he said heartbroken. Poor guy was heartbroken.
Get a life, Brian.
Yeah, really, come on, grow up. But you know, whatever. The thing is now. Technology, we can watch this stuff. I mean, you know, it's online. Anybody wants to watch this whole meltdown, it's there for you to see. And for me, one of the best parts, and I think I mentioned it before, was Ellen Flynn Giles, who said, you know, it's not about us. It's about the kids, damn it. Can we get back to, you know, taking care of education? Which I thought was a very good statement. But, you know, their dysfunction has gotten a lot of people riled up, and even to the point where, again, Explorer Howard...
A lot is lost in political debate, not just at the Board of Education level, but in the legislature and Congress. We sometimes forget what this is about.
It's about the kids.
Well, the Board of Ed, it's about the kids.
Yeah. Right. So, anyway. Another kind of dysfunction that happened this week or since our last show was, it wasn't really a dysfunction. I think it was a miscommunication of some sort. CA had contracted apparently with a disc jockey to do a teen event at the other barn over in Oakland Mills. And apparently whoever was responsible for doing it or signing the contract with CA didn't run it by legal and wasn't aware that there or somebody missed the point. There was a stipulation that the promoter would get a share of the proceeds.
Right. I think he was supposed to get a couple $100 plus some head.
Right. He was paid for being the disc jockey, but he was incentivized to get more people to come. So what does he do?
He said, it's going to be the greatest party in Columbia in 10 years. Come on down.
Facebook, all the social networks were fired up with it. Twitters, you know, it was getting...
Tweets.
Yeah. And he violated one of the cardinal rules. He attempted to attract people outside of Howard County.
And as Paula Poundstone told us a number of years ago when she came into town, Howard County and Columbia specifically has gates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't try to come in.
You know, I've often said, for people who don't live here, we should provide day passes.
You know? Sort of like Walt Disney.
Yeah. You can come in, enjoy yourself during the day.
Can you register what time you want to come
in? You can work here, but, you know, come some down, back across the board.
Get out.
And this violated that rule.
CA canceled the event.
They canceled the event, and Mr., I think his name is Doug Staub, who actually is a Columbia resident, he's all up in arms.
Well, I think he actually claimed that this was a partnership, and we were doing this together. And really, if it's a partnership, then CA really shouldn't have the right to cancel something without conferring with their partner.
True.
So,
but, you know, look, I imagine that. Do you think he's talking to an attorney?
No.
Not enough money. Yeah.
But I think he's claiming he's talking to an attorney, which I get all day, every day. Yeah. I'm going to have my attorney call you. You do that. I'd appreciate
you
that.
You do that. I love talking to attorneys, right? But, there it is. So
apparently Harrod County is too expensive for young families is the topic of an article in the Baltimore Sun. And interesting article. There's apparently a decline in both the number of children and toddlers living in Harrod County, as well as the number of people between the age of 30 and 39. And I actually think the Department of Planning and Zoning may have been involved in some of this study. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
But anyhow, it questioned whether this community is one where young families can afford to live. And apparently, according to the 2012 self-sufficiency standard for Maryland, you need to make just shy of $84,000 a year family of four.
Right.
And so this article questioned whether we've created a community that's just not affordable for young families anymore, which is interesting because a lot of people come to this community with their young families for the purposes of
schools, which we've talked about. Yeah. I mean,
and, you know, if they can't afford to come here for the schools, then part of the very attraction of Harrod County somewhat falls by the wayside.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about, you know, there are people in other counties, I won't name them, around us, where the parents feel compelled to sell, they believe they need to send their kids to private schools in order for them to get a quality education. In Harrod County, you don't see that.
Although I'm always amazed at the number of people that come to Harrod County and then they send their kids to McDonough.
Or Glen Elk Country School.
Whatever. So it is interesting. I mean, it's not that the education system's the only reason to come to Harrod County, but it's a big piece of it.
There's you and I. I mean,
right.
Yeah. And Marsh.
At least you.
Yeah.
So the one quick thing I wanted to mention about this article as well, which I found fascinating, apparently you can get assistance if you are above the poverty level.
Yeah.
So apparently to live in Harrod County, again, you need roughly $84,000, which is 370%
over the poverty level.
And if you're twice over the poverty level, you can actually get food stamps and health insurance for your children. And if you're 175% over poverty level, you can actually get assistance paying your heating and electric bills.
You know, Paul, since...
What is poverty level if we're giving assistance to people at two and three times the level of poverty?
Well, you know, and that's... I tell you, for me, what hit me is since 2008, I'm in commercial real estate. Things have been kind of tough. I'm thinking, I could have gotten food stamps.
And then add the whole proposed gas tax to the equation. We're really going to be
a tax on the middle class.
Yeah, I don't quite get that.
I think it's horrible.
I'm a huge proponent of a consumption tax. You know, what you use, is a consumption tax.
No, it is written in the Bill of Rights. Every American should be able to buy gas for under $3 a gallon. I could have sworn I read that. Of course, I went to Harrod County Schools. Right now, my history teacher is going, "What? What?"
Well, and back when you graduated, it was like the only school, and I think wasn't your classroom like inside a silo?
This is Wild Lake High School.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought.
Wild Lake High School. Anyway, no, you know, you're right. I mean, I think the problem with the gas tax is that everybody understands that it is a consumption tax. If the money's used to pay for roads and to keep an infrastructure of for driving in shape, okay. But that's not what happens with the gas tax.
I did hear that there's a federal pilot program that's being looked at right now to actually install in your car a transponder, I guess, that would transmit the amount of miles that you've ridden, and then you would get taxed based on your miles driven. Can you imagine? You want to talk about Big Brother?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about this at some point in the future, but you know, you got the cams everywhere now that watch in every move you make. You know, they're at the red light intersection.
Well, we talked to our police chief about that.
Yeah,
we talked to our police chief.
Yeah, but there's more to come on that. I put something on my blog this week. We talked about, we're going to get into that on a future show about the Big Brother aspect of all this and whether it's right or wrong.
Why is it a Big Brother and not a Big Sister?
Yeah, I don't know. Because, you know, it's this discrimination against men.
Got it.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering. Your heart goes out for him,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
St. Paralina was in the news again.
Well, before you get to that, just want to mention...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Real quick, gay marriage did pass last night.
Oh, yes.
And we did want to mention that because Senator Alan Kittleman was actually the sole Republican senator that voted in favor of this.
He was,
and
yes.
We had him on, I guess, about a year ago
when he first introduced this.
And he was really the, I think, the impetus to get this passed, despite the fact that he is a Republican.
Republican. Kudos to Alan, because he did a lot of this.
Alan did a great job.
And, we also had Steve Schering on the show, who, he represents the... I can't remember the organization, but it's a
gay and lesbian.
It's a
alliance.
Gay rights alliance here in Howard County, and this is a big step. Now, of course, we expect it's going to go to referendum,
right?
But I think Maryland made a big step. And didn't you say that the governor's going to be on?
I think the governor's going to be on Sunday morning, and it's Meet the Press or one of those shows, and he's going to be talking about that and the referendum.
Do you think he's thinking about his national political aspirations?
I can't imagine. Can't imagine.
I can't either. Actually, before I get into St. Pearl, and I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor, the Columbia Association. And, you hear a lot of times people talk about transparency in government and whatnot. CA is not a government. They're a private homeowners association. But in an attempt to let people understand where their lien-paying dollars go, is they've established a budget blog so people can see actually how their money is spent. And part of this budget, it's kind of neat. Part of this budget blog is they have people within CA, some of the staff, talking about their areas and how it affects, the average homeowner who lives in Columbia and where the money's spent. It's a great idea. I mean, it's not just a spreadsheet, here's the budget.
And is there actually interactive with the...
I believe it is. I believe it is. There's four key elements of it. The economic areas of the budget, there's three sustainability items: economic, societal, environmental, and relational.
That's a great idea.
Boy, do they sound like they were written by somebody in public relations. But anyway, it begins with the fiscal year 13 through 14 budget. It's a blog, so I'm guessing they'll take comments. But, the CA's president, Phil Nelson, he came to this job as being a former city manager and knows that budgets are a big issue and people always want to know where their dollars are spent. So this is a great initiative of his to be, again, to shed more light on where the CA money goes. It's a $60 million year annual budget. I mean, there's a lot of money. So I think this is a great move. You can find the blog at budget1314.blogspot.com. But I think there's probably a link you can find through either CA's Facebook page or on their webpage, at ColumbiaAssociation.com. So again, it's a pretty good step, and I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But anyway, getting back into, I kind of started with St. Parolin. I laugh. We called it St. Parolin because we were trying to figure out where Parolina came from.
Or how you pronounce it.
We've taken to calling it Parolina. It is the inn at Parolina Manor that we're referring to. And this is the boutique, they want to call it a boutique hotel, on Route 108, a couple doors down from the Iron Bridge Wine Company.
Across the street from Clark's Alley Oak Farm.
Yeah, across the street from Clark's Alley Oak Farm. Yeah, beautiful setting. It's a big...
I'm not trying to make an argument or anything that it's not residential.
No,
I'm just saying.
And I got to tell you, I don't know where I come down on this. It's an interesting case. I mean, for one, Route 108 is a very busy commercial road. I mean, you've got Iron Bridge down the road, and you've got, it's certainly more suited to commercial than residential. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to live on Route 108 right there. On the other hand, it backs up to some homes, and it has grown from its original concept, I think, of kind of a boarding house, to now it's pretty much a hotel.
A bed and breakfast sort of place.
On less than 1.5 acres. I don't know how many rooms it has, and it's probably in the article here. But they've all of a sudden found themselves in a position to be a non-conforming use, which means they have to get a zoning amendment passed.
Well, it's not all of a sudden. This has been an issue that's been...
Yeah, it goes back.
This goes back, I think they're finally trying to put some resolution to the issue.
Yeah, Lindsay McPherson's article in Explore Howard said that they've been a non-conforming use since 2001 when a change to the county zoning regulations eliminated the Lynn's boarding house special exception.
You know, it's fascinating to me that they've been a non-conforming use for 11 years.
Yeah.
Yet the Clarksville project down at Pizza Hut, those zoning violations were, just like that. They cited them.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, the little shed behind behind the hardware store.
Fascinating.
All of a sudden, that was
But then there's that.
Well, they had a little bit of a special advocate on their hands with that. And then there's that. But one of the funny things. Again, I come back to. I love this fact that we can now watch these things online. And they had the legislative hearing for this zoning amendment for Paralena this past week. There was a woman who lives behind or adjacent to this inn and who's opposed to it and opposed to them getting a special exemption. And she gets on there. She testifies before the county council that, you know, there was somebody who's staying at the inn that was staring over the balcony at the inn at her backyard and in through her windows. I'm trying to figure out how you stare from a balcony into the window, but...
And as I suggested at lunch, you know, my guess is most people that go to a bed and breakfast are otherwise occupied and have something better to do than stare out the window into other people's houses.
You think?
Yeah.
In February. Well, and her point was, though, this has violated her privacy in the fact that she can no longer walk around her yard in her nightgown.
And this is different because if the house was privately owned by someone, that would be different.
If I'm her neighbor and she's walking around,
you don't want to see her.
I don't want to see her in a nightgown either.
So with that...
On that note, this is a great time to introduce our guest.
The Director of Planning and Zoning, Marcia McLaughlin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we recognize that you are probably not able to speak to current zoning matters that are before the county council or still under consideration by your office. So we're going to do our best to stay away from those. But to the extent that we cross that line, feel free to kick, scream, do whatever you got to do.
Or just say no comment.
We'll do.
So. Yeah. So before we get into some land use issues that have, in my opinion, plagued this county for a number of years, can we just talk a little bit about yourself? How did you come to this position, and how in the world do you become a director of planning and zoning?
I came here from a job in Baltimore County, and I had been, or Baltimore City rather, and had been working in a number of other places, California, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Wow.
Some really tough assignments.
And you're here, why?
You were working in the, and you ended up back here?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, real quick, it's funny, I just got back from the British Virgin Islands,
yeah?
And we were actually commenting. How do you own property up on that hill, and where are the lines, and how do you decide what you can do up there? So it's interesting.
They have zoning everywhere. My background was in landscape architecture, and I eventually got into planning because you can do a wonderful project on your particular parcel, but if they have something really awful happening on either side, it doesn't work to you.
So yeah, that's true.
Sort of got into a bigger perspective.
Okay.
Wandered here over a number of years.
Okay. So what does the Department of Planning and Zoning do?
We do a pretty broad range of things. Right now, we're working on the update to the general plan, which is a countywide look at the future of the county in terms of the economy, the environment, our communities.
And how often does that happen?
It's about every decade.
Every decade, okay.
And so we're working hard on that at the moment. And that's the big picture look of where are we going, so that you then have a context for trying to figure out in the shorter term, you know, what are some steps that'll get us to where we want to go. Some of our staff work on things like development review or zoning cases. Others work on things like transportation planning or environmental planning. So we have a pretty broad range of things we do, which keeps us busy and fun.
Well, you're always in the news. I mean, we've just in the past, I guess it was two, was it 2 years ago we passed the town center?
Yes.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
2010.
2010. And that was big stuff for you guys.
It took forever.
Yeah.
It's still taking forever.
And we're still working on it.
to that end, actually, news came out this week that Mark Thompson has been hired to
be an ombudsman or something.
Ombudsman.
No, it's a...
He's going to be the downtown redevelopment coordinator.
Could you explain that role a little bit and tell us how that fits into your world? And...
I think you all followed the downtown plan development, which did go over an extended period of time.
And I participated in the charrette when I was 13.
Yes, I think you were.
I think the planning board is still trying to make a recommendation.
That was a struggle, too. We're basically doing a lot of things now, not only with Howard Hughes on their first project, but also CA is working on Symphony Woods, mm-hmm. and General Growth Properties is actually working on an amendment or a modification out by L.L. Bean area.
Right.
So we have a number of projects in the pipeline, but there's a lot of other pieces. I think most of you are aware that there's this magic term called a SEPA that is in the downtown plan.
Yes. SEPA is C-E-P-A.
C-E-P-P-A.
Oh, C-E-P-P-A. And it stands for?
Community Enhancements and programs and amenities.
You think it would be pronounced SEPA if there were two P's, but yeah.
Or there'd be another E in there, yeah.
Well, I guess we haven't been criticized on our pronunciation yet. But we're working on all those things.
Hang tight, it's coming.
Yeah, we probably will. Probably will. There's always so many things to criticize us for, though, so why worry about that?
Absolutely.
there are lots of communications between us and all the property owners, as well as all the agencies, and I think we just felt like we needed somebody who was going to be working, particularly in the longer term, on some of the things that go beyond what planning and zoning normally does.
Such as?
We do that. Well, for example, there is supposed to be a downtown partnership that will be an entity that is formed by a number of the key stakeholders, but will also engage the commercial property owners that will be paying 25 cents a square foot into the partnership to do a variety of things related to transportation, marketing, promotion, some kinds of enhancements to how the downtown is operated in terms of streetscape and amenities and things like that. There is a affordable housing fund that will be set up.
Now, this downtown partnership, just before we move on from it. So, if I own an office building in town center already, will I be subject to that assessment?
No, it's only for new development, subject to the new downtown rules.
So they'll benefit.
Yes, they will.
But they won't have to pay into it.
That's the way it's set up at this point in time.
Now, this position, does this report up to you?
It basically is part of the executive's office, but his office is right next to mine, and we are communicating on a regular basis. So I think his role will be helping us get to the point where we set up some of these new organizations like the partnership, the housing, Affordable Housing Fund. There is also an Arts and Culture Commission.
Oh, that's right.
And then there will be ongoing representation by the county on all of those because we're one of the major stakeholders. And so I think a large part of his role will be in some of those organizations on a continuing basis representing the county on things that don't necessarily directly relate to planning and zoning's role.
I want to go back to something you said. You said your office is right next to the execs. I guess that because...
We're actually the floor below the execs.
Right next to Mark.
But Mark Thompson is next to me.
Right next to you.
Pay attention.
My comment was because unless you're running for governor, a county exec spends a lot of time on planning and zoning issues.
Right.
Most executives like to avoid planning and zoning issues to the extent that they can.
But that's
they're lightning rods.
They are. They're lightning rods. Absolutely.
It's a no-win situation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, inevitably, there's somebody who is upset by anything, no matter how good it is. So one of the things I was curious about is, you know, in the early development of Columbia, it was the Rouse Company. And they had the general manager of Columbia.
Right.
And that was kind of a Mark Thompson role.
Well, it was an Al Scavo role, but
Al Scavo, and then I mean
Dennis Miller,
and a lot of people. Even back Mike Spear. So, is this kind of because now we don't have that?
Well, not really, because John DeWolf is representing Howard Hughes as their point person in Columbia.
But they're only one piece of the pie. You guys got General Growth and CA, and
you have more players.
Yes,
now
we have more players.
Did.
We have more players, particularly
with divergent interests.
Right, absolutely.
And competing interests in some way.
Right.
So Mark is kind of the unaffiliated player.
Well, he's affiliated with us, with the county.
But just not with Rouse.
The honest broker.
Right. He is, but he is. That's really the role, is to try and be a coordinating role to try and bring the various stakeholders together, and there are going to be different combinations of stakeholders depending on the organization.
I think Mark is uniquely qualified for the job. I know him very well. Matter of fact, he is. We just heard from him today. He's going to come on and talk to us a little bit about this on March 23rd, so we're happy to have that.
Look forward to that.
Yeah.
So, Marcia, it seems to me that, and I guess this is true in all land use circles, but it comes down to a fight for property rights in many respects. And there have been a number of instances over the last several years here in Howard County where, you know, we talked about somebody wanting to put cell towers inside silos, and should they have the right to do this, and, you know, how does this really injure other people? How do you come up with that balance, just at a high level, not case specific, but how do you, as an office of Department of Planning and Zoning, balance individual property rights with changing communities and changing paradigms, but yet at the same time, you know, the right to own property is so inherent in America.
It's tough, and if you are in the planning circles, if you go to Europe, it's a very different way that they balance, because property rights have a much less impact in Europe than they do in the United States.
Okay.
I've had planners from Holland come in and wonder why we allow farmers to ever develop any of their land. Why don't you just tell them they can't have any rights? You know? So it just depends on what you're used to.
Right.
I think We've had a number of things in the newspapers recently, again, about the kind of conflict in the rural areas between, you know, cell towers, whether in silos or out of silos.
Putting weddings on your farms or
those kinds of
wineries.
Things. And that's probably a good example. We have different cases in the more, you know, developed parts of the county, but in the rural areas, it's a good case example where you've got very different perspectives. People spend a lot of money. As you talked earlier about it being expensive to live in Howard County. It costs a lot of money to buy a piece of property in the rural area, and people like it just the way it is. And they
plus
really
infrastructure
there.
You have narrow roads, and you know.
But on the other hand, the farm community is, you know, it's a tough way to make a living.
Yes.
You know, if you're, you know, trying to make a living as a farmer, it's very difficult, and farming is changing. You get more value for your crops if you're actually like the winery bill. If you sell grapes at wholesale, you don't make much money. If you can turn them into wine, it's a much higher profit factor. Right. So agriculture throughout Central Maryland and other urbanized areas is changing drastically, and we're trying to find that balance. And, you know, at a higher level, you know, in Howard County, we have certain areas that we've designated under zoning and in terms of where we bought development rights from farms for AgPres.
Right.
Those are the places where we think that the rules ought to be balanced towards farming. And there are other places where we have not invested in purchasing development rights, and there's a lot of residential, and that's where it's been sort of clustered through density sending. And in those areas, you need to balance maybe towards the rights of the residential property owners. So, you know, when we finish the general plan, we will be starting up on one of our favorite tasks, comprehensive zoning. And we will have to deal with that balance.
Now how does the general plan and the what's the difference between the two?
General plan is a much more of a higher level document where you set policies, and one of the policies will be to find a better balance in the rural areas in terms of those property rights and interests. And, you know, one of the actions is, you know, to reevaluate the zoning, you know, top to bottom when we do the comprehensive zoning. So that'll be one of the early high priorities for implementation.
And not sucking you into a conversation where you don't want to go, but Route 108 during this area that we talked about with Carolina is actually an example, I would imagine, of the kind of place where you have changing demography and changing uses, and that would probably be the subject of an amendment to zoning regs.
Conceivably.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that without getting into the specifics of that case, one of the things that's difficult is that, you know, zoning and how people want to use their land evolves over time. Our first zoning was done in 1948, and it was like 8.5 sheets of paper. There were about 3 of them, and they were folded in half and stapled in the middle, so it was like a little half-sized document.
Wouldn't you like to go back to the simple days?
But, you know, if you develop something under those rules, you're grandfathered, despite all the changes since then. So we often have things that become obsolete, which was the problem with Paralina.
Right.
We don't do boarding houses. That's just not a very contemporary use. And so when they came in as a boarding house, the rules were very general and vague from having been created a very long time ago. And
yeah, I'm sorry. When I hear boarding house, I think of kind of like a flop house. You know, I don't think of a nice inn, but.
Be just a family that takes in boarders to make a little money, and you know, they provide like a pension situation. But we don't do a lot of that in Howard County.
And early in Howard County's years, though, when it was largely agricultural, a lot of teachers lived in places like that in the schools because there weren't apartments. There weren't those kind of houses.
Right. So what happens is sometimes you have something that was allowed under old rules that don't make any sense and that didn't do a very good job of then that balancing act between their rights as the owner and what the neighbor's rights may be. So that's what the bill that's before the council is intended to do, is to try and clearly define what may or may not be done in that kind of a boutique hotel so that everybody has the same understanding, and hopefully then that balance is struck in a way that everyone can live happily together.
So is a boutique hotel the new word for a boarding house?
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, there's a couple of places. And
sounds better, though, doesn't it?
It does. A boutique hotel, boarding house. And
say boutique. It sounds a little more French.
Yeah, right. You have, there's been a couple of big issues in Howard County where zoning has come up, even well-planned out current zoning, has come up against current realities. And Daisy, the car dealership problem out in Daisy, and then the intermodal proposal down in Elkridge. You know, these are issues where the zoning was in place, but then when it came time to actually do something, it creates a lot of problems. How does your department get, what happens when somebody says, I know you're allowed to do that, but I want to stop it? What does a citizen do? Do they come to your department and say?
Well, the citizens, if they want to stop something, will often come, and there's usually a process for approval, and they have the ability, if it's something that goes through either the planning board or the hearing examiner or the council, they have an opportunity to testify during those contexts in hopes of it being not approved. But a lot of things are handled administratively, so it's really a question of if there aren't other rules, laws, whether they're county planning and zoning laws or fire code or health department rules, if they're allowed under the regulations, we don't really have much ground to deny it just because a neighbor doesn't want it.
If it's permitted as a matter of right.
Right. So that in those instances, they can appeal, and then it sort of takes it up through a hierarchy of appeals process. And I think the WCI Tower was an example of a case that went on and on and on through the courts and has never been decided by the courts.
Right. Well, eventually, they just kind of... It petered out because of the economy. I mean, the economy killed that project.
Well, I think the building permits on that may have just expired, if I'm not mistaken. So they actually lasted for a while.
They were extended for the entire time they were in the appeals process, and I have not talked to Bob Francis from Inspection of License Permits to know if that has changed.
So picking up on what Dennis talked about with the intermodal Elk Ridge debacle. So my understanding is that use is a God-given right in that zone.
Yes.
God-given?
Yes.
Well, you might
Marsha-given, which is the god of planning and zoning in Howard County.
I like it.
I don't know that the council feels that way. I think the council gets to make the rules.
But
we get to implement them.
Well, that's where I'm going with this. I mean, if this isn't a political issue, I don't know what is. I mean, there are residents that don't want this in place. There are elected officials that want to get reelected. And you know what? They're fighting a fight against the very rules that they were sworn in to live by because they're trying to get reelected. I'm just going to be blunt. So what options do they really have to fight this and kill this from a legal perspective?
Well, this one is even more complicated because this is a project that is going through federal approvals under the National Environmental Policy Act.
Right.
So there's a NEPA process, and the whole decision...
There are two P's in that as well?
There's only one P in that.
I'm not going to go there.
So it becomes a process where they have to make comments through that NEPA process to the federal government, and the federal government is looking at the four sites that have been proposed, and they will be evaluating the pluses and minuses in terms of impacts of those four sites. I have no idea how NEPA, which, you know, is done by EPA, not EPA, and how they will weigh citizen, you know, concerns about noise or lights or...
There's another variable, too, the Federal Transportation Surface Transportation Act, which gives the railroads certain rights that supersede zoning, correct?
Well, CSX's line was there long before we had our 1948 zoning.
Right.
Yes. And,
right.
And I think there are interstate trade issues and things like that.
That line goes back to revolutionary days. I mean, it was one of the first railroad lines in the country.
1833, I think.
Yep. And I think that's really interesting because you get a lot of communities that come out fighting things. But their communities arrived, were developed and built, these people moved in after a neighboring property had a right to do what they either did at the time or are now doing. And the Department of Planning and Zoning passed these housing projects next to these projects. Shouldn't these owners come in subject to what the neighbor's property owners have a right to do?
We see a lot of people who, before they buy a house, will come in and look at the general plan
which
in terms of policies and zonings, and we'll try and figure out what's allowed in the neighborhood, what's allowed
a lot,
on the neighborhood.
But not everyone.
But not everyone.
Yeah.
Most people are much more excited about, you know, how good are the schools and, you know, what the price is and all of the amenities of the house. And it's unfortunate that more people don't make those inquiries because clearly, you know, people knew that railroad line was there. I mean, there's passenger and freight traffic that goes back. I think... The land that was zoned for industrial use, which allows this freight intermodal facility under the zoning, you know, it really hasn't had intensive uses. It's kind of not highly visible accessible, and I don't think anyone really realistically thought they were going to have a problem from a use on the other side of the tracks. They were probably maybe thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to have to put up with the noise of freight trucks going by.
It's probably one of the last pieces of M2 land to be developed in the county because it's a tough piece to develop. I mean, it's got slope. It's not, I mean, for developers, we like flat land that's easy to...
Well, and it's also a very long, narrow piece.
Yeah, it's a long,
it's
narrow
not a great place. If you wanted to put a building, it wouldn't lend itself very well.
With your setbacks, it kills you at the end of the day. Yeah.
There's another industrial parcel off Snowden River Parkway where there's an industrial park and there's that little sliver, that community right near the entrance to Gateway.
Oklahoma Mills Road, the Guilford East Industrial Park.
Okay.
There was a warehouse built in 1970. I actually know some of the history. We work with the owners of the building, so in full disclosure. They were one of the first industrial buildings built in Columbia. Back then, it was rail served. The rail spur actually came into Columbia. There's rail doors in the back of it. But now...
They're sandwiched between that Snowden, the Home Depot area, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
now they've built townhomes kind of right up against it. Mm-hmm. And now you have people who have bought into those townhomes who don't like the truck noise and lights.
It starts at 4 and 5 in the morning. They're the distribution center. So anyway, it's an interesting... Dilemma, I think, for a lot of people.
Unfortunately, the dilemma will probably be one we will continue to face and perhaps increase over time, only because Howard County is the second smallest county in Maryland, and it's a great place to live. It's a great place to have a business. People want to be here, and so we're continuing.
Number two place, Money Magazine?
I think it's probably number one.
Okay.
Best place to date a geek.
You know. Yes, all of those wonderful things. The thing is, you know, we don't have a lot of land to put things on. And because we've had a policy of making the 60% of the western part of the county rural and keeping it rural, it means we are continuing to develop more intensively in the eastern 40%. And so we end up with, as things change, you know, you talked about that area along Snowden that was well served. You know, it doesn't have an industrial character to it anymore.
No.
There are a lot of things going on, but it's changing. And that Snowden River corridor is changing, just as Route 1 is changing. And sometimes we're seeing new uses coming in next to old uses that maybe...
May not seem compatible.
May not seem compatible, but then the question is, where are things transitioning? You know, if some things have been turning over and changing, then is that trend going to continue?
Then what is the role of government? In Daisy, the government stepped in and bought the property. We can't always do that.
No, we can't.
Nor is that the role of government. We're kind of coming up against our end of our show here, but I have two quick issues I want to make sure that we touch on. The first is Route 1. If we just get an update from you, it seems to be taking a lot longer than I think anyone had hoped.
Well, it is 10-plus miles long, and,
you
know, runs from 95 all the way to the Anne Arundel border, so it's a lot of territory. We always knew it was going to be a 25- or 30-year plan. After we got the task force report and the zoning in place, we actually were very pleased at how much development was happening in terms of proposals. The downturn in 2008 has certainly had a major impact, but if you go back out to Route 1 just north of 175, you'll see that Howard Square, Blue Stream, Lorien Nursing Home are all under construction now, and so, you know, it's starting up again.
It's going to take a while.
It's going to take a while.
And you've had to go back and revisit some. I think they've determined it's not going to be an office-intensive area ever.
Probably not. Or very limited locations right on interchanges.
My last question, and you may not be able to go there, update on Clarksville and...
What's the project called? Greenstone Ventures?
I can't really give you too much of an update on that. I know that there are ongoing discussions about what should be done with the county's gateway property.
Right.
I think progress is being made in terms of some discussions, but I don't know.
So discussions continue between the county executive's office and Kendall's and trying to figure all that out.
Right.
Okay, very good.
Just as a schedule, so your general plan you're working on now?
Working on now. We hope to have a draft that will be out for the public to look at before too long.
And will that be on a web available?
It'll be web available. And we have a U-Comment software so that you can actually comment on the web. And if you really don't want to come and be at the planning board on Thursday nights until 11 o'clock waiting your turn to comment, you can actually comment online.
Now, will those planning board meetings for that also be available on video, like the county council meetings and the school board meetings?
We haven't talked about that yet.
You're such a geek.
I love this stuff. How many people want to watch the planning board on Thursday? It's possible. I think that
a handful of bloggers in Howard County. Yes,
it's possible. We're also going to do some open houses because I think happens is that we're trying to make this a leaner, meaner document this time, so it's not so heavy. It might be more readable, but it's still a lot to digest. And we thought maybe we'd do some open houses, you know, in different parts of the county, just having some stations where people could get a quick impression of what's in there and ask questions to find out, you know, what they're interested.
So that's going to go spring into summer with that.
Yeah, we're hoping that sometime middle of this year we'll be done with our general plan.
Okay. Maybe we're going to do a little partnership between the real estate agents in town with your general plan and do a little open house at their houses on Sundays. Combine them, you know?
Oh, great idea.
You like that? Marcia,
I don't know how much draw we get.
Yeah, stick to law.
They don't know how much draw they're getting either.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks,
fun.
We appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Okay, so my rant this week is, you know, we have for our social world now, we have these social networks like Facebook that allows us to stay in touch with things. And for most business people, there's also a thing called LinkedIn. Now, in a social network, somebody wants to be a friend. I mean, they can kind of be not a real close friend, but, you know, most of us have, like, people that we know.
Acquaintances
that become our friends on Facebook and whatever. On LinkedIn, I've noticed lately that I'm getting all these requests from people I have no idea who they are. And I got to figure that because I'm linked to somebody that's like three or four people removed from them, they think that they can link back and be a friend of me. Well, the whole idea of LinkedIn is that you can somehow be a referral network for other people. How am I going to refer somebody I have no idea who they are. They could be Ted Bundy, for all I know, under a new name. But that's my rant. You know, if you're going to ask me to link to me on LinkedIn, at least shake my hand at one point or know me. So that about wraps up yet another episode of And Then There's That. Together with my co-host, Paul Scowney, we'd like to thank our sponsor, the Columbia Association, and our producer, Dave Bittner, who makes us look good on the Internet. We'd also like to thank General Growth Properties and the Mall in Columbia for hosting our show again today. We'll be back again on March 12th with special guest District 3 County Council member Dr. Calvin Ball for a discussion about the new Bland Air Park and Bridge Columbia, the transportation initiative. We hope you'll join us.